in the Army, and a bit of background.
We're on tape right now. Well, I joined the Army from the farm, you know, and actually, back in those days there wasn't much money around, so we thought, well, the best thing to do is to be a hero like your dad was. So I guess that's why we joined the Army. My brother and I joined together. My brother's name was Joe. He was a year younger than I was. But he was more anxious than I was, actually, to join the Army. And I told him, as we were being sworn in, I says, you know, this might cost you your life, Joe. Now, you can change your mind. No, no, he says, we're going to this thing, we're going into it together. So that's the way we got in the Army. But our first 2 years in the Army was spent, actually, first 6 months actually were spent in training. Our next 2 years, practically 2 years, was spent down in the West Indies. And that was the best 2 years of my life in Jamaica. It was really beautiful. Then we came back and we thought, well, now we're going into action over in Europe. And we were only over in Canada, I guess, a couple of months at the most. And then we were moved out, and we were issued tropical equipment, and we figured, oh, we're going back to some place like Jamaica, and we weren't very happy about this. But as it turned out, we were heading right into a theater of war to Hong Kong. And we weren't there any longer than, I guess, what I would imagine. We were there about 6 weeks to 2 months, 6 weeks about, I think, when the 7th of December, it was the 8th in this country, it was the 7th over there, and we were attacked, came under aircraft attack.
What was it like over there before the war broke out? Was it sort of just another good time? Or?
It was a beautiful country. There was tension. You could tell something was coming, but it was, everything was placid, and it's a beautiful place. Hong Kong is one of the most beautiful places we visited. People were very nice to us. The Chinese were very friendly. And the British, of course, were naturally the same. But what disturbed me mostly was, as we were getting off our boat, our 2,000 odd men, the British were loading two battalions of their crack troops back on to go back to England. This we couldn't understand. So, however, it didn't bother us too much at the time, and we didn't realize that, as we found out afterwards, we didn't realize at the time that the people that were taking pictures from the dock watching us coming down the gangplank were 50% Japanese infiltrators. But our next 3 or 4 weeks were very pleasant, going out in the evenings when we could get a pass and so on. And we were under very heavy training. They trained us very heavily on the new Bren guns, etc.
What were you doing for equipment then, like you did?
Well, our equipment was just light. We had no heavy equipment with us. We had no tanks of any description. No Bren gun carriers of any description. We did have the new Bren guns, but not enough of them. And instead of beating the Japs up at the 30-mile limit in the and what they call the new frontier in China, off Kowloon, which is the city we landed at. We didn't land in Hong Kong. It was a city called Kowloon on the coast of China. And we should have met the troops up there and been ready for them. However, the outcome would have been the same anyway, because we were by far outnumbered. As a matter of fact, when the onslaught came on the 7th of December, which would be the 8th here in Canada. I imagine, no, I'm wrong. That's the other way around, isn't
it? The 9th there.
It would be the 8th there, and it would be the 7th here in Canada.
Yeah.
But anyway, when they came, they just came across the border, and they overran one of our companies. D Company was the company. And the rest of us had evacuated over to the island. Well, it was just like sitting out in the end of a limb. And all they had to do was saw the limb off, because we had nothing to... We couldn't fight back. There was no Navy, there was no Air Force, there was just us. And it was approximately 8 days to 10 days later the Japs landed on the island very quietly, without any, very little resistance. But when they got on the island, I will admit that our boys did a very good job, especially the Royal Rifles and the Royal Scots of Britain, and our own Grenadiers did a wonderful job in trying to stop them. We lost a lot of good men, very good friends of mine and Ashley, and they did a swell job. And when I first came under fire, I was so scared I didn't know my name, and I said, oh my God, I'm a coward. And a buddy came along and he hit me on the shoulder with his rifle butt. He says, come on, Fury, get on your feet. We've got to stop him. So I got up and I said, all right, I want it. We'll fight it. And if I wanted the, if I'm going to get it, I want to get it fast and quick, like, because the Japanese, they claimed at that time, didn't take prisoners. This was the last thing we heard, and it stuck in our minds always. However, we spent 3 days and 3 nights there, and we ran out of food, and most of our men were wounded. We had 5 or 6 men left, and I myself was wounded. My buddy beside me was wounded, but not serious enough to lie down. But we ran out of food. We ended up by drinking English carrot juice, and that ran out. I'd never drank carrot juice in my life before. But it was, we hadn't had any sleep for at least, I would say, 2 days anyway. And then one night when our last officer got wounded, we had a British officer sent a subaltern out and said, throw your hands up and yell, we surrender. Well, I heard this in the middle of the night, and that's the first sleep I had.
Did you... You mentioned that they cut off your communication lines and things like that when they came onto the island. Did things get pretty scattered? Like, where were you during the fighting?
I was at a place called Wong Li Chong, and this was from our home base approximately 3 to 4 miles. And even telephone contact had been cut by the Japs. They were clever enough to know where everything was. This was all figured out ahead of time anyway, months and months before we got there. We found this out afterwards. We were told by the Japanese after we became prisoners of war. And it was just a matter of survival, and nobody wanted to surrender, because we heard that it's just the bayonet, that there was no other way. They're not going to take any prisoners. They're in too big a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
They're going other places, Singapore, etc. But we did finally give up, and we were searched, and we were lined up at one time. We were lined up to be shot, and we were taken to the bottom of a ravine. I'll never forget it. And I saw the sun coming up in the morning. And I thought, that's the last time I'll ever see the sun. I wasn't scared then. I was just sad that this is the way it had to be.
Mm-hmm.
And we were tied together, all us prisoners. I think there was around 25 to 30 of us. And they lined us up and put 2 machine guns out at a short distance. And I said, thank God. At least we're going to be shot down, not bayoneted. And all of a sudden there was a truck came along at the top of the ridge on the road, and a Japanese officer came down and he literally almost beat the life out of this NCO that was handling this thing and kicked him, and I don't know whether he lived or died, but he put him in a very bad condition. And immediately called us all up out of there, and we waited till nightfall. Our own guns were shelling us, but they didn't know it, of course. And we were marched out of there that night. We marched 7 miles from there to a point called North Point Camp. And when they untied me at North Point Camp, my arms wouldn't come from behind my back. I had to work for several minutes or longer to get my arms to come back where they belonged, in front of me. And strangely enough, there was men, women, and children in this place, but they disappeared overnight. I don't know where they took them. And we got messages and slipped them to these people to send back home that we were prisoners, but they never did arrive. From there on end was a sequence of prison camp to prison camp. Mm. And finally about, we were working on the airport, building an airport at Hong Kong, the extended, and we were bombed several times by the Americans, which was equally as bad as being bombed by the enemy. And that wasn't very comfortable. But eventually, 2 years later, I was transferred to a camp called Sendai No. 2 in Japan. It was near a little town called Taira. I would say about 125 miles north of Tokyo. And I spent the rest of my prison life in there, in the prison, in the coal mine. Oh, roughly to 2,000 feet under the ground or more. Mm-hmm. But the food became a wee bit better towards the end. Pardon me. And the B-29s were becoming more plentiful every day. And we kidded the Japs about this. They didn't like it at first, but towards the past 6 months, they realized that it was the beginning of the end, you know. And even after the we heard about the big bomb being dropped in Hiroshima, we couldn't believe it, and my buddy hit me on the shoulders, and if you'd asked me my name, I wouldn't have known it. And anyway, some of them were crying, and some of them were laughing, and so on. The Americans dropped us good clothes. They were terrific to us. They even dropped flea powder, and boy, did we need it. They did.
Yeah, that was one of the biggest things.
Oh, lice and fleas and the bed bugs, you know. They even dropped that. They thought of everything. And food. They dropped enough food there to do the whole Japanese army. And we were there 3 or 4 days, and we gouged ourselves until we were sick. A lot of the fellows were very sick because they weren't used to this strong food. Finally, a Japanese officer came up from a train that used to run below that hauled the coal out that'd be mined. And he said, "We're all invited to get aboard this plane," and that's where we embarked to go to Tokyo, which was a 4 or 5 hour trip, I should say, which was only about 100 miles, so they were very slow. But that first, then we ran into the American Army, mm-hmm. in the docks there. And there we were taken aboard the Missouri, and we spent 2 beautiful days there. First time we'd seen bacon and eggs, ice cream for over 4 years. Saw a picture show, it was all changed. Heard of radar for the first time. The Americans were terrific with us. A couple of days after that, we were invited up on board, and anyone who wanted to fly home could fly. So a lot of the fellows didn't want to fly. They said, "No, we'll go home by boat." But I liked the idea of the airplane, and I was back in San Francisco in very short order. We spent 2 weeks in Hawaii, and they gave us complete medical there. I don't know why. But after that, then they flew us straight to San Francisco. We stayed there a few days, and then we got back to Canada. It was all financed by American funds. Mm-hmm. How that was straightened out, I'll never have any idea financially.
When did you first run into the Canadian government, the Canadian people?
We didn't run into a Canadian soldier or a Canadian officer at all until we got to right into Canada, actually.
Or Gordon Head.
Gordon Head in Vancouver, off Vancouver, yes, that's right. And no disrespect to them, but we sure had more liberty with the Americans than we ever did with their own people. Although, once we got back, they didn't waste too much time in letting us get to our families. We were shipped through in a couple of days right to our hometown, dropped right off my town of Carbery, as a matter of fact.
So they just dropped you off the train right at Carbery?
Well, we asked. No. A lot of them were taken straight to Winnipeg, people who lived at distant points, but we made a special request, the chaps from our area, that we could be dropped off there, and they did stop the train there long enough to let us off.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was a little bit against regulations, but we had to report in a week or so later to the authorities anyway, you see. But all in all, I weighed about 145 pounds when I got back. When I joined up, I was about 170 pounds. I guess my lowest weight would be around 130 pounds when I was in the prison camp.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to the prison camp as far as North Point. Do you remember the escape attempt?
Yes. And I knew it was an error. That was Johnny Payne, George Buzinski, Percy Ellis, what was the other boy's name? I forget. But anyway, it was a rainy, dirty night, and I saw him going over the roof. I knew it was a mistake, although Johnny Payne was a very clever sergeant. He had a revolver. We knew he had a revolver, but one revolver is not too much. But they were depending entirely on some Chinese that they had made a little deal with while they were out on a working party to use their sampan, which is one of these small boats that they used there. But apparently they had been picked up in the crossing over to the mainland. And needless to say, they never made it. They were caught right there. It was foolish, I thought, in the first place, because a white man stands out against an Orient so clearly that there was little or no chance. I certainly wouldn't have done it. If I thought there was the slightest chance of surviving, I would have gone with him. But
there wasn't really any place you could go, was there?
No. And the Chinese at that time was so frightened of the Japanese, had been for years before, he would turn you in for a bowl of rice anyway if he saw you. And a white man stands out like a sore thumb in the Orient. So I couldn't see the sense of the skip. However, we've got to hand it to the boys for trying. And there's different stories about how they died, but I know they died. They're not here, and they didn't come back to the camp, and I think they were beheaded. Now, this is what we were told, that they had been captured and beheaded.
They treated you people pretty rough after that, didn't
they? Well,
we
had a pretty rough time for a few months after that. They cut our food supply to practically nothing, and they would order us out in the rain in the middle of the night, and it was cold at nights there. And it wasn't very pleasant. And they believed in capital punishment. I didn't mean capital punishment. They believed in the whole entire group should be punished for what one person would do, which is called collective punishment, which is definitely not right in any man's army. And I don't think we deserved what they gave us. It wasn't our fault that the other fellows had escaped. But they took it out on us, of course. I think they were trying to set an example. Well, it was rough on the start, the first 2 years, but towards the last, I think that the last year or more, they realized that they were not going to make it, and their attitude changed rapidly towards the end. And
did your food supplies get better towards the end?
I didn't stay in the same camp, Bill. I didn't stay in the same camp all the time, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't improve too much, I don't think, in the Hong Kong area where I left. But when we did get to Japan, it was gradually improving. Not only were we eating rice, they were starting to throw a few beans in, and I think this saved a lot of our stamina, because a lot of our people have died of malnutrition then, had died then, and have died since. And our particular group didn't fare too badly. We didn't lose too many of our group because of the beans, I think. That's what kept us together, you know.
I wonder if you tell a story about going out and stealing food and getting caught.
Oh, this was in... I got this in Sham Shapo. Sham Shapo was in Kowloon City, maybe 6 months after we had been captured. And we dug holes underneath their barbed wire and out under the high tension wires that they had strung along. And we get out into what we called the sweet potato plants. Now, I don't know whether they were sweet potatoes or yams, but they tasted pretty darn good when we were eating them. And anyway, we'd get out there at night with our greatcoats on. Anybody that had greatcoats, we'd fill their pockets with them, and then crawl back under the fence and fill the hole in. But one night we were out there when there was an air raid on by the Americans. And the Japanese were, I think they were even shooting at the potato fields, not even us, because we were well hidden down between the rows. But we were very lucky to get in that night. Very, very fortunate. And we had a few close calls. We did finally get caught when we were selling. The Koreans came on the scene then. The Japs had conscripted these Koreans from North or South Korea. It doesn't make any difference. And these Koreans were our guards. Well, they were just a bunch of little looters. They didn't care. They weren't Japanese, and they didn't. Their job was to see we didn't escape. But they used to come in at night, and we used to trade our Red Cross jackets. Now, these were jackets that were sent over from Canada and Britain. I think mostly Britain. And they arrived there, and these are the things that we were out stealing at night from their warehouses, the Japanese warehouses. They never give them to us. We'd take them in, and then these Koreans would come around and they would trade us cigarettes and little goodies. And that's what we're out stealing the night that we got into this little schmozzle with the American Air Force. But luckily we got in. However, the Japanese went onto this and they planted a spotter. So I'm getting ahead of my story there. There was one night this Korean soldier came in, and he left his rifle in the corner of this little room where myself and a few other fellows were sleeping. And he put all these jackets on his body, and then put his tunic over top, and he was so excited when he was leaving, he gave us a bunch of cigarettes. He was so excited when he was leaving, he forgot his rifle. Well, after he'd been gone for a while, we realized this rifle stand in the corner. We thought, oh, well, this isn't a very good thing. We're prisoners of war, and we've got a rifle in our room. So he got back the same night, luckily, and he came in after his rifle. Was he upset? But he got his rifle back, and we were glad to get rid of it. We didn't want any such thing. But one night, they put a spotter on us, I began to tell you. He came in and he bought some jackets from myself. We had them underneath the bed, old iron beds that we had there. And I sold him some of these things, and he gave them to him, and he gave me so many packets of cigarettes. And it was, just an hour or two later, and about four officers came in and flashlight in my face. And they took me out. And they took me over to the guardhouse and threw me into a sort of a old, wet, dark room there. There was about four of us they caught that night. So the next day they took us out onto the square and they went at us with their belts and their feet and everything else. And I stood it quite a while, and most of the boys did. A couple of them went down pretty early. But we stood it, and as long as you didn't yell, they weren't too bad. When you started to scream, then they'd really give it to you, you know. And this is where I got this scar here. They went away and left us, and we thought we were all clear. And this one fellow, this one guard, stepped forward, and he just took his rifle butt and brought it right down on here. Just opened my head wide open on this end. And then they tied us and put us underneath the edge of a building, and it rained and poured that night. And I think that's what woke us up, because we were unconscious. And they kept us in that place for, they put us inside then again the next day. They patched up this thing here. I didn't know why they did it. They put some tape on it. And about 2 days later, they brought us in and questioned us, gave us real questioning, and told us that we could be put to death and so on. Then they gave us another day and let us think it over. And finally they came one day and they said, okay, you're free to go back to your quarters. We were amazed. We didn't ever think we'd get out of that. But we got out of there, and this is the time I had to eat this toilet paper because I had somebody's names on them that I owed them for their Red Cross jackets. So I had to eat this paper. Mind you, there wasn't too much of it, but sure it wasn't palatable when you had nothing to wash it down with.
Did you take sick? Did you get dysentery or any of the other?
Yeah, I got jaundice and I got dysentery and I had malaria. But the only thing that put me down was the jaundice. The dysentery wasn't too serious. My brother had dysentery very badly. Incidentally, my brother died there. He died in a prison camp up at Niigata, way north of Tokyo. But anyway, he was in terrific health. He was for his sojourn. You know, he was working on the docks, and he could get his hands on a bit of fruit once in a while and so on. He was well until this catastrophe. The roof caved in on him in his particular camp, and this is where he was killed in Japan. But we found that some people took it better than others. For what reason, I'll never know. Some thought because we were farmers, we took it a little better than what the city people did, but this is just conjecture. We don't know.
You think it had much to do with your state of mind?
Oh, definitely. Oh, absolutely. If you kept an open mind and said, we're not dead yet and we're going to be all right, if you could keep this idea in your mind, I don't think that there was any need for, well, near the death rate that we had, but a lot of people got discouraged and got fed up, and then they got to such an extent where they couldn't get this horrible food down anymore, or couldn't keep it down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they just passed away. They just wilted away. I buried an awful lot of my good buddies. And when we buried them, you know, we buried them in an old army gray blanket. And they only took our dead out about once. In the hot weather, about once every week. In the cold weather, once every 2 weeks. And we go back the next weekend to bury some more. And the Chinese had dug them up and taken the blankets off and thrown the dirt back in the holes again on top of our dead boys. You know? So nobody will ever know where they died.
Did they try to sell you back the blanket factory?
Well, yes, this was done too. But the Chinese needed the blankets so badly themselves that there wasn't too much of them selling them back. Because this was the poverty-stricken Chinese that had been backed into the corner by the Japs themselves, you see.
Mm-hmm.
and we had no weed. They did use coffins for a while, even rough boxes, but they ran out of wood. There's no wood to any extent there anyway. Had to be imported from someplace in or from inner China. So naturally, they just used a blanket, and just all we did is wrap the fellow up, tied both ends of it, and threw him out. That's mm-hmm. all. You get used to it so much, you hardly knew the fellow's name anymore, you know. But there's no way of ever finding out where they're buried, where they lie. That'll clear up a lot of things, really. My mother even asked me, could we get his ashes back? And my brothers, I said, no way. If you got ashes back, it would probably be from a poplar tree.
Yeah.
It was all mixed up, you know, they didn't care. So there's no such thing as getting the body back or anything like that after 6 years.
Did any of the troops, the Japanese troops, sort of feel sorry for you much, or?
No, I could never say that they felt sorry for us. We did get a drink of water after we were first captured from one little Japanese fella who took a pail and just held it up to our mouths and went along. I don't know why he did it. He was just a little wee fellow. And during the prison camp life, there was people that you could get. It was the odd one you could get to talk to, especially if you asked him something about his language. How do you count, for instance? What is your name, and so on. How do you pronounce this? We'd write it down as it sounded to us.
Mm-hmm.
Like a hammer was a yogi. And etc., etc., you know, he got to learn the words. They liked that. They thought, oh, these fellows are trying to learn our language. But I never did actually meet any of them that you could say was downright friendly. There were some of them that left you alone. Let's put it that way. We walked by you and didn't bother me. But there was none of them that you could ever trust. Ever, ever, ever. They just didn't, and towards the end we could have made friends out of anything, but by this time we were starting to become boss. The last 6 months of my captivity, we were telling them what to do. They'd say, we want 20 cars of coal out of that coal shop today, and say, no, you're not going to get it, we're not going to do it. And we found out that we could get away with it too. We said, no, we're only going to put out five. And that's all we did, and we got away with it, because they could see all these planes more and more every day, and they were American planes, and they realized that the war was coming closer to an end, and I think they decided that let's just back off.
Did you have any sort of contact other than just seeing planes and that to know what was going on with the war?
No, we had no. I never saw a radio or telephone. But there was a strange sort of a grapevine that seemed to, rumors would come in, and strangely enough, they turned out to be right a lot of them. I think we called it, or somebody called it, the bamboo telegram. But this was strange. Things you'd hear and how to slip into camp, how to get into camp, I would never know. But it seemed to just sneak through and get these done. But of course, they had a paper for quite a while we were still in Hong Kong, China, as prisoners. And they would say, mention the terrific amount of ships they knocked down in such and such a sea. And the Philippines, they sunk four aircraft carriers. Well, we were catching the drift. What was going on? The Americans were slowly on their way back. This is while the European War was still going on. And then we started to see the big B-29s coming over and the bombings going on. We could see the lights from Tokyo every night. We knew it was getting closer to the end, but what was going to happen to us, we had no idea. But when the big bomb dropped, we heard that. But we heard them talk. We didn't hear the bomb. We were too far away from it. Pardon me. But we heard the Japanese talking about it down in the mine, and we asked them about it, and they said, yes, there was a big bomb drop. Bigger than anybody's ever imagined. It's something phenomenal. And we knew then that it was getting close to the end, and it wasn't more than a week after that that we went out to the gates one morning, and there was nobody there. Happened to find a Japanese someplace, and I asked him, he said, oh, the war's over. But that's the first we knew. And then the Americans come over and drop notes and said, put PW on top of your building so as we don't make any mistakes. And I think you saw pictures of that there, where we put this, wrote it on a whitewash on top of the buildings, PWs, and this is where they dropped the food.
What did you do after the after the Japanese left the camps? Did you just sort of go back to the regimental order?
Not to any great extent, but our seniors did insist that, come on, fellas, get up in the morning and go out and line up and get cognizant. We don't want to lose anybody now. Mm-hmm. And we started to fall back into our military routine. Up to a point, there was no forced marches or drills or anything like that. But NCOs took over, and the officers.
Did you have any officers in your camp?
One. He was an American, and he was a doctor. He wouldn't know any more about it. He was the most wonderful fellow in the world. His name was Captain Schmiela, Schmiela. He was a doctor from Iowa. I don't know the name of the city where he came from, but I could certainly get it for you. I have it in my book. He was a terrific man, a very brave man, too. He demanded stuff from the Japanese that I thought he'd be taken out and shot for. He was terrific. Captain Schmiela, Schmiela. I don't know if it was Sioux City, Iowa, or... I have it. I could supply that information for you sometime. You'd be interested. I know we have... I used to write to him, but I haven't written to him for quite a while. But we did. They fell into land. The boys fell into land. There was no trouble. There was no such thing as anybody taking advantage of a situation where there wasn't adequate officers and non-commissioned officers to look after us. They certainly... The boys all acted very good, and we were so darn happy to get out of there and just get some decent food in our bellies and cigarettes that we weren't wanting to argue with anybody.
You smoked during the war?
As all through it, and then as soon as the war was over, I quit. Yeah. This is the craziest thing you ever heard. All through the prison camp, I smoked.
Did you smoke that stuff that looks like horsehair?
Yeah, that was... Actually, what that was, I think, was just bulk tobacco that had been sunk in the ship, you know, and they brought the ship to the surface. And of course, after tobacco's been in the water, the nicotine's right out of it.
Yeah.
Oh, we tried to smoke this stuff. I forget what they called it now. Isn't that funny? But we mixed it with a little bit of ordinary tobacco when it got. But once the Americans came, of course, the cigarettes came down by the millions from the air, and we didn't have to bother with that stuff anymore.
Do you remember what kind of medical treatment you got? Like, was your medical treatment good or bad?
Oh,
you didn't have any supplies, I guess.
Just practically nil. We had no medical supplies, no medical supplies, nor surgical. Mm-hmm. I had a tooth pulled. I had a tooth pulled in Hong Kong before we left to go to Japan, and it was just pulled. That's all. We didn't even have anything to freeze the gum.
Yeah.
It was just a matter of taking it out. A doctor by the name of Gray. From some part of Canada, I don't know just where. He wasn't belonged to our Grenadiers, but he was belonged to our auxiliary. And there's a doctor by the name of Gray. He took the tooth out. It wasn't very nice. I told him to be as fast as possible. He says, well, can't be too fast. You may take your jaw off. But he took it out, and well, it could have been saved. There was only a small cavity in it, but that's the only one I lost there. I was very fortunate teeth-wise. A lot of other fellows have to have their teeth pulled and no anesthetics. And there was no medic. And then when the diphtheria hit us in 1943, we lost hundreds of men. And our commanding officer, Dr. Crawford, asked them for one horse. And we could see they had horses, or, you know, they used horses for transporting ammunition and so on up the hills and so on. And they wouldn't give us a horse. He said if he gave an inoculation into one of the horses, several days later you could kill that horse or destroy the horse and use all his blood for transfusion. They could stop the epidemic. They wouldn't even give him a horse. This is how unreasonable they were. But medical supplies, nil. None that I ever seen, anyway.
Yeah, it's a wonder you didn't lose more men than you did.
It's amazing. It's amazing. It's amazing what a man can stand before he dies. It sure amazed me. I went blind, and one day got a hold of an old newspaper, and I couldn't read the headlines, and I panicked, and I ran into the commanding officer. And I told him, it was Captain Crawford, Major Crawford, who's our head medical doctor, and I told him, I said, I can't see, and I was panicking. He says, well, join the group. They're all the same. And that was a fact, I couldn't see.
Probably from a vitamin deficiency.
Vitamin deficiency, our eyes were going, and we were going fast. And they made a kind of a comeback, I think, when I went to Japan, but we have a lot of blind in our outfit.
Did you know at the time that they were withholding Red Cross parcels? Were you aware that there was Red Cross parcels there that you weren't getting?
There was always rumors that they were coming, and we did get a few. We got a couple on the start. And we knew that they'd be trying to get parcels soon. We knew they'd be sending them. Mm-hmm. But they were using them themselves, I'm sure, to supply their own troops just wherever they are. As a matter of fact, they even caught one Japanese fellow trying to wash his hands with a piece of cheese. That's right. He didn't know. He had never seen a piece of cheese before. He was a gorilla. Mm-hmm. And he said, American soap, no good. Of course, these parcels had come from Canada. Some of them came from Britain. But he didn't know the difference between a piece of cheese and a bar of soap. Mm-hmm.
The soap was pretty awful, wasn't it?
Oh, no soap. There was no soap.
You didn't get any?
None. No soap. I don't ever remember getting soap of any kind from the Japanese.
You didn't get many baths either, did you?
Well, in the wintertime you couldn't bath, it was too cold. And in the summertime, well, you could get a bath because they kept an old tub full of water there. And by the time you got finished with it, it was filthy dirty anyway. And you couldn't wash clothes because your clothes would come out dirtier than they went in. Consequently, we were all lousy. Oh, you could scrape the lights off inside of your shirt with a spoon, and you could get a spoonful. That's true. And bedbugs, they drove me up a wall. A lot of people could lay right there and never bother them. Strange. Some of the fellows weren't bothered by bedbugs. But myself and several other fellows, really allergic.
Yeah.
The bed bug, he's a clever fellow, the bed bug. He can come out of a hole in the wall, come down like that, and you turn the light on. You weren't supposed to turn the lights on because there was a blackout. Mm-hmm. There'd be a whole line of them coming down. They'd all be the same distance apart out of a hole in the wall. Turn the light on, they go back up and go back in again. Turn the light off again, down they come again. Then they come along, up the leg of your bed, or if you were on a piece of wood, up the wood, and into, and then they'd raise blisters on me, lumps as long as your small finger. Oh, That was the dread of the night.
But you probably didn't get enough sleep hardly to keep.
And that's
going.
What made it worse. Yeah, not enough sleep. But
what sort of strikes me is it must have been the incredible monotony of the thing must have got to you after.
Well, this is what drove some of the fellas over the bend and went and give up. I always had the outlook, and a lot of buddies, we always stuck in sort of little cliques of guys, you know. And said, don't worry about it, fellas. We're going to make it here somehow.
Yeah.
We're going to get out of this thing. It'd always be the hard hand who'd say, oh, what are you talking about? You don't know anything. But the big thing is say, well, if you take that attitude, you won't get out of it. A lot of them didn't. I said, take it easy. Everything's going to be all right. Whether you're going to get it fast or we're going to get out of here nice and easy. But I never doubted that either. I knew something was, of course, it was always in the back of your mind that they're going to take you out some morning and made it the whole works because the Americans came too close. So therefore, we were very thankful for the atomic bomb. There's no two ways about that. None of our fellows would ever tell you that that was a mistake because it saved Japanese lives as well as it saved American lives.
Do you have many ill effects after the war? Like,
Well, right now I'm starting to get quite hard of hearing. Number one, number two, my eyes are getting quite bad, and I'm starting to slow down way too fast. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Faster than I should. Haven't got the strength in my arms anymore, and little things are happening that shouldn't be happening to a man of my age because I was always very active, and. Well, our doctor told us when we were released, he says, fellas, you can count on it that your life will be 15 to 20 years shorter than would be what you'd expect normally if you had never been through this prison camp. And I believe him because it's starting to show up in our fellows now. They're dying very quickly. And when I say quickly, I say, you're hearing more of them every day now.
Yeah, there's been something like 40 in the past year, I think.
Would we across Canada very easily, that, yes.
There's a lot of them going.
Yeah.
Did you have to fight with the government to get your pension? A lot of the men really had bitter fights.
There was bitter fights, and I think the government was very unfair. As far as pensions are concerned, because I don't think there should have been any question at all when the men first came home, but to give them 50% right off the bat, to just to get the thing going, number two, then start feeling out and finding out the people who are in worse condition than others, and start pensioning them off altogether because there were some men, even when they got back, weren't fit to go to work. And I know in my own mind, no, I'm not going to last another 5-6 years as far as working is concerned, being able to lift what I'm doing at my company. I will not be able to do it. I can feel it now.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't see, there was only a handful of men left there. In Quebec, I can't see the government being so close about it. I shouldn't have to get up in the morning now and go to work. I'm tired all the time. I can't do it really anymore. And I can't see why I should have to.
Yeah.
Because I can understand if the government says, oh, 50,000 men to deal with here, but what have they got to deal with? The pension, the old age pensioners from the First World War are all gone, practically. Now from the Second World War, they're all starting to die in our bunch. Particularly, we've lost about 2/3. So why not give the rest of them their full pension and let it go with that? Now, it's not a matter of money. It's a matter of just a little compensation for the awful things that they had to go through.
Well, there seems to be something like where there's some kind of stigma attached to Hong Kong vets, where Hong Kong vets have to fight for everything they get.
Well, of course, the other prisoners of war from Germany and different parts of the world, they're jealous, I think, to a certain extent, and maybe they should be, but that's their problem.
Yeah.
It's not ours. And our problem, I think, is the one that should be dealt with first, because we had the bad feet. I can't sleep with my feet under the covers. Today,
yeah.
Never could. And I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm bitter froze to death. My whole body's cold because
yeah.
If your feet are out, your whole body's going to get cold because you're circulating, your blood circulation is through your feet. So you put your feet in there and a half an hour later, or an hour later, you're too warm again and you have to put your feet back out again.
Is that from what they call happy feet?
That's the happy feet or the Hong Kong feet or whatever you want to call it. We had lots of names for it, I'll tell you. Oh, I'm telling you, you die from your feet up, and this was obvious. And as I say, I'm not kicking. I'm on a 50% bench, and I'll let everybody know it. But I know that in a very few years, I won't be able to carry on my work.
Do you think, are you expecting to have to fight to get... to get it increased when you can't carry on?
I believe that the government's attitude today, it appears to me, I'm not going to get political, the government attitude is today is to hell with them, they've had enough.
Yeah.
This is my opinion. And it's getting more obvious every day. I have to go up to Deer Lodge every 3 months. And I have to get treatment for different things. I was up there today and I had a needle in my arm for arthritis or something. He put some cortisone in it.
Yeah.
And the attitude at Deer Lodge, as far as the doctors are concerned, is so old age, old age, old age. They can't tell me that I came from the farm in the condition I was in. Now they're going to tell me that I'm an old man. I'm only 51 years of age.
It's not old, according to modern standards.
It certainly is not. And 90% of our remaining Hong Kong boys are not in good shape. I don't know whether you've had much to do with them, Bill, or not, but anyway, perhaps someday you'll meet more of them and you'll find out just exactly what's going on.
Yeah, I've met enough to know that most of them are sick in one way or another, and they're sick from what happened over there.
Yes. Well, a lot of it is mental, and you will find some of them who are not willing to work anyway. Well, you'll find this in all groups of people. Even in our young people today, you'll find the good workers, and you'll find the others that don't want to do anything. They want a living free. This is not my attitude, and I don't think it's the attitude of our lads, because percentage itself and the death rate will show you that our lads have been dying off at too great a speed, and the government has turned a deaf ear on it. As far as that is my my opinion, and I am fortunate that I have a good job. And went into business for a while after he got out of the service, which built up a little equity in our home, helped me raise my family. Right today, I couldn't write you out a check for $100.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of them in that situation. A lot of just to sort of sum it up, would you do it again?
I would never. Even under any circumstances, do it again. I would join the service again. I believe I'd be patriotic enough to do that. But if I knew that we were going to have to go through what we went through, I would commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
If I was forced to do it, I would commit suicide. Too long. Too much.
Was the experience worthwhile for anything after it was all said and done? Was it any kind of a learning experience that you feel
no.
sort of
No. It sure, we learned a lot. We learned how inhuman one human being can be to another. And then when we got home, we found out how inhuman your own government can be towards you.
Yeah, right.
They were all right at the start. Oh, we'll do everything for these men. There was going to be no stone unturned. Everything's going to be right.
Mm-hmm.
And after they got 10 or 12 years under our belts, they just backed right off, and especially when our government changed. I'm not going to say it has changed several times, mm-hmm. but our present government has certainly turned a deaf ear to everything we have proposed.
I've heard different other guys say that there's not many of the guys here that would vote liberal.
Well, I won't mention politics, but I certainly didn't like the way we were hoaxed into this thing and then treated like a piece of dirt when we got out of it. And our present government today, being liberal, the federal government, has done little or nothing.
Yeah.
They gave us a little increase a little while ago, and it was an insult. It was actually an insult to our cause. And as far as Winston Churchill is concerned, he sold us up the river at Hong Kong. And I have somewhere in my possessions a telegram to prove that he asked for our aid and took his own two battalions out of Hong Kong and took them back for the Battle of Britain.
That would be the two battalions you saw leaving when you were going?
Yes. The names of one of them was the King's Shropshire Light Infantry, and I believe the other regiment was, I can't think of the name. Some of my buddies will remember it, but they were got on the same ship as we got off, so we were sacrificed to hold on. Pardon me. And we had several telegrams sent to our commanding officer, carry on the good work, Canadians, you will never be forgotten. And on Christmas Day, little did Winston Churchill know, but it was all over. Congratulations on your terrific effort in holding the Japanese, and your names will go down in the annals of history. But there will be no surrender. When I sit and think about that, Mr. Winston Churchill said, go out there and die. Well, I'm glad he's dead. It didn't hurt me a bit when Mr. Winston Churchill died.
And this was after you'd already surrendered.
Oh, we had already surrendered. We were ordered to surrender before that. Oh, yes. He wanted us to die to a man. This is terrific when you're sitting in a nice armchair behind a big black cigar.
Yeah, sending the people all over.
That's right. Well, the sacrifice that we made there wasn't voluntary, of course, but it shouldn't have been forced upon us.
Mm.
If he was going to let the island drop, which he knew was going to happen, why did he sacrifice? What was he treating us Canadians like? Pigs? Things that were dispensable? Throw them out to the wolves? This is exactly what Winston Churchill did.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible.
I will never forgive the British government for any part of what happened. I offered my services to the King George, wrote my name on a piece of paper and said I will fight for my king and country, but I didn't think that they were going to sell me up the river. This is exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want anybody to come up to me and say anything good about Winston Churchill, because they will certainly have a rebuff.
Well, I think we should maybe back it up. It's getting kind of late.
Fine, Bill.
Thanks a lot for it.